The upshot was that domestic governance mechanisms were weakened, while their global counterparts remain incomplete. The flaws of the new approach became evident soon enough. One type of failure arose from pushing rulemaking onto supranational domains too far beyond the reach of political debate and control. This failure was exhibited in persistent complaints about the democratic deficit, lack of legitimacy, and loss of voice and accountability. These complaints became permanent fixtures attached to the World Trade Organization and Brussels institutions. Where rulemaking remained domestic, another type of failure arose. Growing volumes of trade with countries at different levels of development and with highly dissimilar institutional arrangements exacerbated inequality and economic insecurity at home. What was even more destructive, the absence of institutions at the global level that have tamed domestic finance, a lender of last resort, deposit insurance, bankruptcy laws, and fiscal stabilizers, rendered global finance a source of instability and periodic crises of massive proportions. Domestic policies alone were inadequate to address the problems that extreme economic and financial openness created. Suitably enough, the countries that did the best in the new regime were those that did not let their enthusiasm for free trade and free flows of capital get the better of them. China, which engineered history's most impressive poverty reduction and growth outcomes, was, of course, a major beneficiary of others' economic openness. But for its part, it followed a highly cautious strategy that combined extensive industrial policies with selective, delayed import liberalization and capital controls. Effectively, China played the globalization game by Bretton Woods rules rather than by hyper-globalization rules. Is global governance feasible or desirable? By now it is widely understood that globalization's ills derive from the imbalance between the global nature of markets and the domestic nature of the rules that govern them. As a matter of logic, the imbalance can be corrected in only one of two ways: expand governance beyond the nation-state or restrict the reach of markets. In polite company, only the first option receives much attention. Global governance means different things to different people. For policy officialdom, it refers to new intergovernmental forums, such as the Group of 20 or the Financial Stability Forum. For some analysts, it means the emergence of transnational networks of regulators setting common rules, from sanitary to capital adequacy standards. For other analysts, it is private governance regimes, such as fair trade and corporate social responsibility. Yet others imagine the development of accountable global administrative processes that depend on local debate, is informed by global comparisons, and works in a space of public reasons. For many activists, it signifies greater power for international non-governmental organizations. It remains without saying that such emergent forms of global governance remain weak. But the real question is whether they can develop and become strong enough to sustain hyper-globalization and spur the emergence of truly global identities. I do not believe they can. I develop my argument in four steps. 1. Market-supporting institutions are not unique. 2. Communities differ in their needs and preferences regarding institutional forms. 3. Geographic distance limits the convergence in those needs and preferences. And 4. Experimentation and competition among diverse institutional forms is desirable. Market-supporting institutions are not unique. It is relatively straightforward to specify the functions that market-supporting institutions serve, as I did previously. They create, regulate, stabilize, and legitimate markets. But specifying the form that institutions should take is another matter altogether. There is no reason to believe that these functions can be provided only in specific ways, or to think that there is only a limited range of plausible variation. In other words, institutional function does not map uniquely into form. All advanced societies are some variant of a market economy with dominantly private ownership. But the United States, Japan, and European nations have evolved historically under institutional setups that differ significantly. These differences are revealed in divergent practices in labor markets, corporate governance, social welfare systems, and approaches to regulation. That these nations have managed to generate comparable amounts of wealth under different rules is an important reminder that there is not a single blueprint for economic success. Yes, markets, incentives, property rights, stability, and predictability are important, but they do not require cookie-cutter solutions. Economic performance fluctuates, even among advanced countries, so institutional fads are common. In recent decades, European social democracy, Japanese-style industrial policy, the U.S. model of corporate governance and finance, and Chinese state capitalism have periodically come into fashion, only to recede from attention once their stars faded. Despite efforts by international organizations such as the World Bank and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, to develop best practices, institutional emulation rarely succeeds. One reason is that elements of the institutional landscape tend to have a complementary relationship to each other, dooming partial reform to failure. For example, in the absence of labor market training programs and adequate safety nets, deregulating labor markets by making it easier for firms to fire their workers can easily backfire. Without a tradition of strong stakeholders that restrain risk-taking, allowing financial firms to self-regulate can be a disaster. In their well-known book, Varieties of Capitalism, Peter Hall and David Soskus identified two distinct institutional clusters among advanced industrial economies, which they called liberal market economies and coordinated market economies. We can certainly identify additional models as well if we turn to Asia. The more fundamental point has to do with the inherent malleability of institutional designs. As Roberto Unger has emphasized, there is no reason to think that the range of institutional divergence we observe in the world today exhausts all feasible variation. Desired institutional functions, aligning private incentives with social optimality, establishing macro stability, achieving social justice, can be generated in innumerable ways, limited only by our imagination. The idea that there is a best practice set of institutions is an illusion. This is not to say that differences in institutional arrangements do not have real consequences. Institutional malleability does not mean that institutions always perform adequately. There are plenty of societies where institutions patently fail to provide for adequate incentives for production, investment, and innovation, not to mention social justice. But even among relatively successful societies, different institutional configurations often have varying implications for distinct groups. Compared to coordinated market economies, liberal market economies, for example, present better opportunities for the most creative and successful members of society, but also tend to produce greater inequality and economic insecurity for their working classes. Richard Freeman has shown that more highly regulated labor market environments produce less dispersion in earnings, but not necessarily higher rates of unemployment. There is an interesting analogy here to the second fundamental theorem of welfare economics. The theorem states that any Pareto-efficient equilibrium can be obtained as the outcome of a competitive equilibrium with an appropriate distribution of endowments. Institutional arrangements are, in effect, the rules that determine the allocation of rights to a society's resources. They shape the distribution of endowments in the broadest term. Each Pareto-efficient outcome can be sustained by a different set of rules, and conversely, each set of rules has the potential to generate a different Pareto-efficient outcome. I say potential because bad rules will clearly result in Pareto-inferior outcomes. It is not clear how we can choose ex ante among Pareto-efficient equilibria. It is precisely this indeterminacy that makes the choice among alternative institutions a difficult one, best left to political communities themselves. Heterogeneity and diversity. Immanuel Kant wrote that religion and language divide people and prevent a universal monarchy. But there are many other things that divide us. As I discussed in the previous section, institutional arrangements have distinct implications for the distribution of well-being and many other features of economic, social, and political life. We do not agree on how to trade equality against opportunity, economic security against innovation, stability against dynamism, economic outcomes against social and cultural values, and many other consequences of institutional choice. Differences and preferences are ultimately the chief argument against institutional harmonization globally. Consider how financial markets should be regulated. There are many choices to be made. Should commercial banking be separated from investment banking? Should there be a limit on the size of banks? Should there be deposit insurance? And if so, what should it cover? Should banks be allowed to trade on their own account? How much information should they reveal about their trades? Should executives' compensation be set by directors with no regulatory controls? What should the capital and liquidity requirements be? Should all derivative contracts be traded on exchanges? What should be the role of credit rating agencies? And so on. A central trade-off here is between financial innovation and financial stability. A light approach to regulation will maximize the scope of financial innovation, the development of new financial products, but at the cost of increasing the likelihood of financial crises and crashes. Strong regulation will reduce the incidence and costs of crises, but potentially at the cost of raising the cost of finance and excluding many from its benefits. There is no single ideal point along this trade-off. Requiring that communities whose preferences over the innovation-stability continuum vary all settle on the same solution may have the virtue that it reduces transaction costs in finance, but it would come at the cost of imposing arrangements that are out of sync with local preferences. This is the conundrum that financial regulation faces at the moment, with banks pushing for common global rules and domestic legislatures and policymakers resisting. Here is another example from food regulation. In a controversial 1998 case, the World Trade Organization sided with the United States in ruling that the European Union's ban on beef reared on certain growth hormones violated the Agreement on Sanitary and Phytosanitary Standards, SPS. It is interesting that the ban did not discriminate against imports and applied to imported and domestic beef alike. There did not seem to be a protectionist motive behind the ban, which had been pushed by consumer lobbies in Europe that were alarmed by the potential health threats. Nonetheless, the World Trade Organization judged that the ban violated the requirement in the SPS agreement that policies be based on scientific evidence. In a similar case in 2006, the World Trade Organization also ruled against the European Union's restrictions on genetically modified food and seeds, GMOs, finding fault, once again, with the adequacy of the European Union's scientific risk assessment. There is indeed scant evidence to date that growth hormones pose any health threats. The European Union argued that it had applied a broader principle, not explicitly covered by the World Trade Organization, the precautionary principle, which permits greater caution in the presence of scientific uncertainty. The precautionary principle reverses the burden of proof. Instead of asking, is there reasonable evidence that growth hormones or GMOs have adverse effects, it requires policymakers to ask, are we reasonably sure that they do not? In many unsettled areas of scientific knowledge, the answer to both questions can be no. Whether the precautionary principle makes sense depends both on the degree of risk aversion and on the extent to which potential adverse effects are large and irreversible. As the European Commission argued unsuccessfully, regulatory decisions here cannot be made purely on the basis of science. Politics, which aggregates a society's risk preferences, must play the determining role. It is reasonable to expect that the outcome will vary across societies. Some, like the United States, may go for low prices. Others, like the European Union, will go for greater safety. The suitability of institutional arrangements also depends on levels of development and historical trajectory. Alexander Gershenkron famously argued that lagging countries would need institutions, such as large banks and state-directed investments, that differed from those present in the original industrializers. To a large extent, his arguments have been validated. But even among rapidly growing developing nations, there is considerable institutional variation. What works in one place rarely does in another. Consider how some of the most successful developing nations joined the world economy. South Korea and Taiwan relied heavily on export subsidies to push their firms outward during the 1960s and 1970s and liberalized their import regime only gradually. China established special economic zones in which export-oriented firms were allowed to operate under different rules than those applied by state enterprises and to others focused on the internal market. Chile, by contrast, followed the textbook model and sharply reduced import barriers to force domestic firms to compete with foreign firms directly in the home market. The Chilean strategy would have been a disaster if applied in China, because it would have led to millions of job losses in state enterprises and incalculable social consequences. And the Chinese model would not have worked as well in Chile, a small nation that is not an obvious destination for multinational enterprises. Alberto Alesina and Enrico Spolaure have explored how heterogeneity in preferences interacts with the benefits of scale to determine endogenously the number and size of nations. In their basic model, individuals differ in their preferences over the type of public goods, or in my terms, the specific institutional arrangements provided by the state. The larger the population over which the public good is provided, the lower the unit cost of provision. On the other hand, the larger the population, the greater the number of people who find their preferences ill-served by the specific public good that is provided. Smaller countries are better able to respond to their citizens' needs. The optimum number of jurisdictions, or nation-states, trades off the scale benefits of size against the heterogeneity costs of the provision of public good. The important analytical insight of the Alesina-Spolaore model is that it makes little sense to optimize among the market size dimension and eliminate jurisdictional discontinuities when there is heterogeneity in preferences along the institutional dimension. The framework does not tell us whether we have too many nations at present or too few, but it does suggest that a divided world polity is the price we pay for institutional arrangements that are, in principle at least, better tailored to local preferences and needs. Distance lives. The limits to convergence. We need to consider an important caveat to the discussion on heterogeneity, namely the endogenous nature of many of the differences that set communities apart. That culture, religion, and language are in part a side product of nation-states is an old theme that runs through the long trail of the literature on nationalism. From Ernest Renan down, theorists of nationalism have stressed that cultural differences are not innate and can be shaped by state policies. Education, in particular, is a chief vehicle through which national identity is molded. Ethnicity has a certain degree of exogeneity, but its salience in defining identity is also a function of the strength of the nation-state. A resident of Turkey who defines himself as Muslim is potentially a member of the global community, whereas a Turk owes primary loyalty to the Turkish state. Much the same can be said about other characteristics along which communities differ. If poor countries have distinctive institutional needs arising from their low levels of income, we may perhaps expect these distinctions to disappear as income levels converge. If societies have different preferences over risk, stability, equity, and so on, we may similarly expect these differences to narrow as a result of greater communication and economic exchange across jurisdictional boundaries. Today's differences may exaggerate tomorrow's differences. In a world where people are freed from their local moorings, they are also freed from their local idiosyncrasies and biases. Individual heterogeneity may continue to exist, but it need not be correlated across geographic space. There is some truth to these arguments, but they are also counterweighed by a considerable body of evidence that suggests that geographic distance continues to produce significant localization effects, despite the evident decline in transportation and communication costs and other man-made barriers. One of the most striking studies in this vein was by Anne-Celia Dizdier and Keith Head, which looked at the effect of distance on international trade over the span of history. It is a stylized fact of the empirical trade literature that the volume of bilateral trade declines with the geographic distance between trade partners. The typical distance elasticity is around negative 1.0, meaning that trade falls by 10% for every 10% increase in distance. This is a fairly large effect. Presumably, what lies behind it is not just transportation and communication costs, but the lack of familiarity and cultural differences. Linguistic differences are often controlled for separately. Dizdier and Head undertook a meta-analysis, collecting 1,467 distance effects from 103 papers covering trade flows at different points in time, and stumbled on a surprising result. Distance matters more now than it did in the late 19th century. The distance effect seems to have increased from the 1960s, remaining persistently high since then. If anything, globalization seems to have raised the penalty that geographic distance imposes on economic exchange. This apparent paradox was also confirmed by Matthias Bertillon and Caroline Frund, who found an increase in the absolute value of the distance elasticity from negative 1.7 to negative 1.9 between 1985 and 1989, and between 2001 and 2005, using a consistent trade data set. Bertillon and Freund showed that the result was not due to a compositional switch from low to high elasticity goods, but to a significant and increasing impact of distance on trade in almost 40% of industries. Leaving this puzzle aside for the moment, let us turn to an altogether different type of evidence. In the mid-1990s, a new housing development in one of the suburbs of Toronto engaged in an interesting experiment. The houses were built from the ground up with the latest broadband telecommunications infrastructure and came with a host of new internet technologies. Residents of Netville, a pseudonym, had access to high-speed internet, a video phone, an online jukebox, online health services, discussion forums, and a suite of entertainment and educational applications. These new technologies made the town an ideal setting for nurturing global citizens. The people of Netville were freed from the tyranny of distance. They could communicate with anyone in the world as easily as they could with a neighbor, forge their own global links, and join virtual communities in cyberspace. One might expect that they would begin to define their identities and interests increasingly in global rather than in local terms. What actually transpired was quite different. Glitches experienced by the telecom provider left some homes without a link to the broadband network. This situation allowed researchers to compare wired and non-wired households and reach some conclusions about the consequences of being wired. Far from letting local links erode, wired people actually strengthened their existing local social ties. Compared to non-wired residents, they recognized more of their neighbors, talked to them more often, visited them more frequently, and made many more local phone calls. They were more likely to organize local events and mobilize the community around common problems. They used their computer network to facilitate a range of social activities, from organizing barbecues to helping local children with their homework. Netville exhibited, as one resident put it, a closeness that you don't see in many communities. What was supposed to have unleashed global engagement and networks had instead strengthened local social ties. There are plenty of other examples that belie the death of distance. One study identified strong gravity effects on the internet. Americans are more likely to visit websites from nearby countries, even controlling for language, income, immigrant stock, etc. For digital products related to music, games, and pornography, a 10% increase in physical distance reduces the probability that an American will visit the website by 33%, a distance elasticity even higher in absolute value than for trade in goods. Despite the evident reduction in transportation and communication costs, the production location of globally traded products is often determined by regional agglomeration effects. When the New York Times recently examined why Apple's iPhone is manufactured in China rather than in the United States, the answer turned out to have little to do with comparative advantage. China had already developed a massive network of suppliers, engineers, and dedicated workers in a complex known informally as Foxconn City that provided Apple with benefits that the United States could not match. More broadly, incomes and productivity do not always exhibit a tendency to converge as markets for goods, capital, and technology become more integrated. The world economy's first era of globalization produced a large divergence in incomes between the industrializing countries at the center and lagging regions in the periphery that specialized in primary commodities. Similarly, economic convergence has been the exception rather than the rule in the post-war period. Economic development depends, perhaps more than ever, on what happens at home. If the world economy exerts a homogenizing influence, it is at best a partial one, competing with many other influences that go the other way. Relationships based on proximity are one such offsetting influence. Many, if not all, exchanges are based on relationships rather than textbook-style anonymous markets. Geographic distance protects relationships. As Ed Lemer put it, geography, whether physical or cultural or informational, limits competition since it creates cost-advantaged relationships between sellers and buyers who are located close to one another. But relationships also create a role for geography. Once relationship-specific investments are made, geography becomes more important. The iPhone could have been produced anywhere. But once relationships with local suppliers were established, there are lock-in effects that make it difficult for Apple to move anywhere else. Technological progress has an ambiguous effect on the importance of relationships. On the one hand, the decline in transportation and communication costs reduces the protective effect of distance and market relationships. It may facilitate the creation of long-distance relationships that cross national boundaries. On the other hand, the increase in complexity and product differentiation, along with the shift from Fordist mass production to new distributed modes of learning, increases the relative importance of spatially circumscribed relationships. The new economy runs on tacit knowledge, trust, and cooperation, which still depend on personal contact. As Kevin Morgan put it, spatial reach does not equal social depth. Hence, market segmentation is a natural feature of economic life, even in the absence of jurisdictional discontinuities. Neither economic convergence nor preference homogenization is the inevitable consequence of globalization. Experimentation and competition. Finally, since there is no fixed, ideal shape for institutions and diversity is the rule rather than exception, a divided global polity presents an additional advantage. It enables experimentation, competition among institutional forms, and learning from others. To be sure, trial and error can be costly when it comes to society's rules. Still, institutional diversity among nations is as close as we can expect to a laboratory in real life. Josiah Ober has discussed how competition among Greek city-states during 800 to 300 BCE fostered institutional innovation in areas of citizenship, law, and democracy, sustaining the relative prosperity of ancient Greece. There can be nasty sides to institutional competition. One of them is the 19th-century idea of a Darwinian competition among states, whereby wars are the struggle through which we get progress and self-realization of humanity. The equally silly, if less bloody, modern counterpart of this idea is the notion of economic competition among nations, whereby global commerce is seen as a zero-sum game. Both ideas are based on the belief that the point of competition is to lead us to the one perfect model. But competition works in diverse ways. In economic models of monopolistic competition, producers compete not just on price, but on variety, by differentiating their products from others. Similarly, national jurisdictions can compete by offering institutional services that are differentiated among the dimensions I discussed earlier. One persistent worry is that institutional competition sets off a race to the bottom. To attract mobile resources, capital, multinational enterprises, and skilled professionals, jurisdictions may lower their standards and relax their regulations in a futile dynamic to outdo other jurisdictions. Once again, this argument overlooks the multidimensional nature of institutional arrangements. Tougher regulations or standards are presumably put in place to achieve certain objectives. They offer compensating benefits elsewhere. We may all wish to be free to drive at any speed we want, but few of us would move to a country with no speed limit at all, where, as a result, deadly traffic accidents would be much more common. Similarly, higher labor standards may lead to happier and more productive workers, tougher financial regulations to greater financial stability, and higher taxes to better public services, such as schools, infrastructure, parks, and other amenities. Institutional competition can foster a race to the top. The only area in which some kind of race to the bottom has been documented is corporate taxation. Tax competition has played an important role in the remarkable reduction in corporate taxes around the world since the early 1980s. In a study on OECD countries, researchers found that when other countries reduce their average statutory corporate tax rate by 1 percentage point, the home country follows by reducing its tax rate by 0.7 percentage points. The study indicated that international tax competition takes place only among countries that have removed their capital controls. When such controls are in place, capital and profits cannot move as easily across national borders, and there is no downward pressure on capital taxes. So the removal of capital controls appears to be a factor in driving the reduction in corporate tax rates. On the other hand, there is scant evidence of similar races to the bottom in labor and environmental standards, or in financial regulation. The geographically confined nature of the services or public goods offered by national jurisdictions often presents a natural restraint on the drive toward the bottom. If you want to partake of those services, you need to be in that jurisdiction. But corporate tax competition is also a reminder that the costs and benefits need not always neatly cancel each other. Although it is not a perfect substitute for local sourcing, international trade does allow a company to serve a high-tax market from a low-tax jurisdiction. The problem becomes particularly acute when the arrangement in question has a solidarity motive and is explicitly redistributive, as in many tax examples. In such cases, it becomes desirable to prevent regulatory arbitrage, even if it means tightening controls at the border. What do global citizens do? Let's circle back to Theresa May's comments at the beginning of this chapter. What does it even mean to be a global citizen? The Oxford English Dictionary defines citizen as a legally recognized subject or national of a state or commonwealth. Hence, citizenship presumes an established polity, a state or commonwealth, of which one is a member. Countries have such polities. The world does not. Proponents of global citizenship quickly concede that they do not have a literal meaning in mind. They are thinking figuratively. Technological revolutions in communications and economic globalization have brought citizens of different countries together, they argue. The world has shrunk, and we must act bearing the global implications in mind. And besides, we all carry multiple, overlapping identities. Global citizenship does not and need not crowd out parochial or national responsibilities. All well and good. But what do global citizens really do? Real citizenship entails interacting and deliberating with other citizens in a shared political community. It means holding decision-makers to account and participating in politics to shape the policy outcomes. In the process, my ideas about desirable ends and means are confronted with and tested against those of my fellow citizens. Global citizens do not have similar rights or responsibilities. No one is accountable to them, and there is no one to whom they must justify themselves. At best, they form communities with like-minded individuals from other countries. Their counterparts are not citizens everywhere, but self-designated global citizens in other countries. Of course, global citizens have access to their domestic political systems to push their ideas through. But political representatives are elected to advance the interests of the people who put them in office. National governments are meant to look out for national interests, and rightly so. This does not exclude the possibility that constituents might act with enlightened self-interest by taking into account the consequences of domestic action for others. But what happens when the welfare of local residents comes into conflict with the well-being of foreigners, as it often does? Isn't disregard of their compatriots in such situations precisely what gives so-called cosmopolitan elites their bad name? Global citizens worry that the interests of the global commons may be harmed when each government pursues its own narrow interest. This is certainly a concern with issues that truly concern the global commons, such as climate change or pandemics. But in most economic areas, taxes, trade policy, financial stability, fiscal and monetary management, what makes sense from a global perspective also makes sense from a domestic perspective. Economics teaches that countries should maintain open economic borders, sound prudential regulation, and full employment policies, not because these are good for other countries, but because they serve to enlarge the domestic economic pie. Of course, policy failures, for example, protectionism, do occur in all of these areas. But these reflect poor domestic governance, not a lack of cosmopolitanism. They result either from policy elites' inability to convince domestic constituencies of the benefits of the alternative, or from their unwillingness to make adjustments to ensure that everyone does indeed benefit. Hiding behind cosmopolitanism in such instances, when pushing for trade agreements, for example, is a poor substitute for winning policy battles on their merits, and it devalues the currency of cosmopolitanism when we truly need it, as we do in the fight against global warming. Few have expounded on the tension between our various identities, local, national, global, as insightfully as the philosopher Kwame Anthony Appiah. In this age of planetary challenges and interconnection between countries, he wrote in response to May's statement, the need has never been greater for a sense of a shared human fate. It is hard to disagree. Yet cosmopolitans often come across like the character from Fyodor Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, who discovers that the more he loves humanity in general, the less he loves people in particular. Global citizens should be wary that their lofty goals do not turn into an excuse for shirking their duties toward their compatriots. We have to live in the world we have, with all its political divisions, and not the world we wish we had. The best way to serve global interests is to live up to our responsibilities within the political institutions that matter, those that exist within national borders. Who needs the nation-state? The design of institutions is shaped by a fundamental trade-off. On the one hand, relationships and preference heterogeneity push governance down. On the other hand, the scale and scope of the benefits of market integration push governance up. A corner solution is rarely optimal. An intermediate outcome, a world divided into diverse polities, is the best that we can do. Our failure to internalize the lessons of this simple point leads us to pursue dead ends. We push markets beyond what their governance can support. We set global rules that defy the underlying diversity in needs and preferences. We downgrade the nation-state without compensating improvements in governance elsewhere. The failure lies at the heart of globalization's unaddressed ills, as well as the decline in our democracy's health. Who needs the nation-state? We all do. Chapter 3. Europe's Struggles. The Eurozone was an unprecedented experiment. Its members tried to construct a single, unified market in goods, services, and money, while political authority remained vested in the constituting national units. There would be one market, but many polities. The closest historical parallel was that of the gold standard. Under the gold standard, countries effectively subordinated their economic policies to a fixed parity against gold and the requirements of free capital mobility. Monetary policy consisted of ensuring the parity was not endangered. Since there was no conception of countercyclical fiscal policy or the welfare state, the loss of policy autonomy that these arrangements entailed had little political cost. Or so it seemed at the time. Starting with Britain in 1931, the gold standard would eventually unravel precisely because the high interest rates required to maintain the gold parity became politically unsustainable in view of domestic unemployment. The post-war arrangements that were erected on the ashes of the gold standard were consciously designed to facilitate economic management by national political authorities. John Maynard Keynes's signal contribution to capitalism was recognizing that it required national economic management. Capitalism worked only one country at a time, and economic interactions among countries had to be regulated to ensure they did not impinge too much on domestic social and political bargains. The European Single Market Initiative, and even more so, the single currency, flew in the face of this understanding. It is worth considering the possible narratives under which such a leap into the danger zone could have made sense. What were we thinking? One theory, perhaps held most strongly by conservative economists, rejected the Keynesian perspective and re-enshrined the self-equilibrating market at the center stage of policy. In this worldview, the apparent malfunctions of markets, the boom and bust cycles in finance and macroeconomics, inequality and low growth, were the product not of market failures, but of too much government intervention to begin with. Do away with moral hazard in financial markets, institutionalized labor markets, countercyclical fiscal policy, high taxes, and the welfare state, and all these problems would disappear. This free market nirvana had little use for economic governance at any level, national or European. The single market and currency would force governments into their proper role, which was to do very little. Transnational political institutions were a distraction at best and harmful at worst. A second theory was that Europe would eventually develop the quasi-federal political institutions that would transnationalize its democracies. Yes, the single market and currency had created an imbalance between the reach of markets and the reach of political institutions, but this was temporary. In time, the institutional gaps would be filled in, and Europe would develop its own Europe-wide political space. Not only banking and finance, but fiscal and social policy as well would become EU-wide. This image envisaged a significant amount of convergence in the social models that exist around the EU. Differences in tax regimes, labor market arrangements, and social insurance schemes would have to be narrowed. Otherwise, it would be difficult to fit them under a common political umbrella and finance them out of a largely common fiscal pot. The British, with their own sense of uniqueness, understood this well, which is why they always pushed for a narrow economic union and resisted anything that smacked of political union as well. Neither of the two theories, the minimalist nor the federalist, could be articulated too openly. Doing so would have raised a torrent of criticism and objections. The minimalist economic model had little attraction beyond a narrow group of economists, and the federalist model would run up against widely divergent views even among the pro-European elites about the political future of the Union. That these opposing, but at least internally coherent visions could not even be widely discussed in polite company, should have told us something. Neither, in fact, offered a practical solution to the Eurozone's institutional imbalance. but the absence of public discussion and debate meant that they would not be explicitly repudiated. So both justifications lingered on in the background, providing their adherents some comfort about the sustainability of the Union's arrangements. The Eurozone's problems, deflation, unemployment, and economic stagnation on the economic side, and voter dissatisfaction and the rise of extremist parties on the political, no longer allow such equivocation. The elusive promise of structural reform. The immediate problem in Europe is how to revive growth. Here, Germans and other creditor nations have clung far too long to the notion that the answer lies in what's known as structural reform. Structural reform, or more accurately, talk of structural reform, is everywhere nowadays. Every country struggling for economic growth, it seems, is getting the same message from the chattering classes, as well as the deep-pocketed multilateral finance agencies like the IMF and the European Central Bank. Half measures are not enough. In practice, structural reform has come to represent a grab bag of policies meant to enhance productivity and improve the functioning of the supply side of the economy. These measures aim to sweep away impediments to the functioning of labor, goods, and services markets, to make it easier for firms to fire unwanted employees, to break business and union monopoly power, to privatize state assets, to reduce regulation and red tape, to remove licensing fees and other costs that deter market entry, to improve the efficiency of the courts, to enforce property rights, to enhance contract enforcement, and so on. Indeed, the grab bag is even bigger. Often, for example, structural reform includes changes in taxes and social security programs with an eye toward fiscal sustainability. The overarching goal of structural reform is to increase the efficiency with which labor and capital are allocated in the economy, ensuring that these resources go where their contribution to national income is largest. Success comes in the form of increased productivity, more private investment, and, of course, more rapid economic growth. Perhaps nowhere in recent years has the gospel of structural reform been promoted with greater vehemence than in Greece. Indeed, Greece's creditors have made it crystal clear that structural reform, boldly conceived and implemented without slippage, is critical to economic recovery and growth. And most persuasively to Greeks, that bailout funds will not be forthcoming without it. The International Monetary Fund and European public lenders understood that the fiscal austerity they prescribed would be costly to incomes and employment, though a retrospective IMF study later showed they significantly underestimated by how much. But there would be a compensatory boost to the economy, they argued, that would come from the long-delayed and much-needed opening of the Greek economy to competitive market forces. The specifics demanded from Greece ranged from mundane to gut-wrenching. They included, in no particular order, lower barriers to entry in service businesses such as notaries, pharmacies, and taxis, reduced scope of collective bargaining, privatization of state assets, a rollback of pensions, and the cleanup of Greece's notoriously inefficient and arguably corrupt tax administration. The IMF's then-chief economist, Olivier Blanchard, among others, argued that such reforms were critical in light of the dismal productivity growth record of Greece before the program. Less ambitious reforms wouldn't do because they would have less impact on growth potential and necessitate greater debt relief. Partial amnesia. But the policy prescribers, it seems, suffered from selective memory. Structural reform as a remedy for slow or no growth has been around at least since the early 1980s. At that time, in return for structural adjustment loans, the World Bank insisted on economy-wide liberalizing reforms for developing countries in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. These policies were then extended and codified in Latin America during the 1990s under the umbrella of the Washington Consensus. Many of the former socialist economies adopted similar policies, in some cases voluntarily, when they opened up their economies during the 1990s. A serious look at the vast experience with privatization, deregulation, and liberalization since the 1980s in Latin America, post-socialist economies, and Asia in particular, would have produced much less optimism about the reforms Athens was asked to swallow. That experience suggests that structural reform yields growth only over the longer term at best. More often than not, the short-run effects are negative. One meta-study of 46 different research papers on post-socialist economies found that the impact of structural reform varied across the board. The modal estimate of the impact was statistically insignificant, meaning that it was impossible to conclude with any confidence whether the effects were positive or negative. In Latin America, for example, some economies have flourished in the wake of reform. Think of Chile, and some have lagged, as in Mexico. These results may seem surprising at first, but are, in fact, consistent with what economic theory teaches. The standard convergence framework that economists use to analyze growth across countries gives us little reason to expect strong short-term growth-promoting effects. Reform works by raising the potential income of the economy in the long run. In Greece, opening the regulated professions will eventually lead more productive firms to drive out inefficient suppliers. The privatization of state enterprises will lead to the rationalization of production and dismissal of all the excess workers employed through political patronage. These changes will require years to work themselves through the economy. In the short run, they may yield perverse effects. For example, the loss of the however disappointing output of workers laid off by privatized enterprises will subtract from, rather than add to, national income. Economists have spent significant effort at estimating the speed with which economies tend to converge to their long-run levels of income. The near consensus of academic studies is that convergence is pretty slow, at a rate of about 2% per year. That is, an economy tends to close 2% of the gap each year between its actual and potential income levels. This estimate helps us gauge the magnitude of growth we can expect from structural reform. Let's be wildly optimistic and suppose that structural reforms enable Greece to double its potential income over 3 years, which would push Greece's potential per capita gross domestic product, GDP, significantly beyond the European Union average. Applying convergence math, this would produce an annual growth boost of only about 1.3% per year on average over the next 3 years. To place this number in perspective, remember that since 2009, Greek GDP has shrunk by 25%. So, if structural reforms have so far not paid off in Greece, it is not necessarily because the country's governments have slacked off. Indeed, it is easy, but also largely erroneous, to blame successive Greek governments for unenthusiastic implementation of structural reform and significant slippages. Certainly, Greece has not delivered on every measure it agreed to adopt. Given the magnitude of effort needed, which government could? Yet, remarkably, Greece moved up by nearly 40 positions between 2010 and 2015 in the World Bank's Ease of Doing Business rankings. The country's labor markets are more flexible or liberalized today than those of most other Eurozone countries. Greece's failure arises instead from the very logic of structural reform. The bulk of the benefits comes much later, not when their creditors and unemployed Greeks need them most. Takeoffs? This leaves us with an apparent puzzle. There are numerous instances of abrupt takeoffs in East Asia and elsewhere. If structural reforms deliver their growth payoffs so slowly, how are we to explain these? If such takeoffs are not the product of conventional structural reform, what does drive them? A decade ago, Ricardo Hausmann, Lant Pritchard, and I published an article that documented the basic stylized facts about what we called growth accelerations. We defined a growth acceleration as an increase in per capita growth of 2 percentage points or more, with most of the episodes we identified exceeding this threshold by a wide margin. To qualify as acceleration, the increase in the growth rate had to be sustained for at least 8 years, and the post-acceleration rate had to be at least 3.5% annually per capita. In addition, to rule out cases of acceleration purely attributable to recovery from recession, we required that post-acceleration output exceed the pre-episode peak level of income. We were surprised to discover how frequent these episodes of growth acceleration are. We identified more than 80 cases over the 35-year period from 1957 to 1992. This meant the probability that any given country would experience a growth acceleration sometime during a decade was as high as 25%. Of the 110 countries included in the sample, 60 had at least one acceleration in the 1957 to 1992 period. More important, we found that standard factors economists think play a role in growth do not do a good job of predicting acceleration. In particular, structural reforms were only loosely correlated with turning points in economic performance. Fewer than 15% of significant economic liberalizations produced growth accelerations, and only 16% of growth accelerations were preceded by economic liberalization. Some growth accelerations were obviously the result of fortuitous external conditions, such as a rise in the world prices of a country's major exports, or other changes not directly attributable to economic policy, such as changes in political regime. But in most cases, there was no smoking gun. That got us thinking about what might lie behind these instances when economic prospects suddenly brightened. India's growth acceleration in the early 1980s is perhaps a paradigmatic case. The country's growth rate more than doubled from 1.7% in 1950 to 1980 to 3.8% in 1980 to 2000, with a clear turning point in 1981 to 1982. Yet serious liberalizing reforms in India did not arrive until 1991. When Manmohan Singh slashed trade barriers, welcomed foreign investment, and began both privatization and the dismantling of what is derisively called the License Raj. In other words, the pickup in India's growth preceded the 1991 liberalization by a full decade. Arvind Subramanian and I concluded that the trigger to India's economic growth was a shift in attitude toward the private sector on the part of the national government in 1980. Until that time, the rhetoric of the reigning Congress Party had been all about socialism and pro-poor policies. When Indira Gandhi returned to power in 1980, she realigned herself politically with the organized private sector and dropped her previous rhetoric. The national government's attitude toward business went from being outright hostile to supportive. Note that this was a pro-business shift rather than a pro-market shift. It was not supported by strong liberalizing reforms, which would only come a decade down the road. Indira Gandhi's switch was further reinforced in a more explicit manner by Rajiv Gandhi after his rise to power in 1984. This seems to have been the key change that unleashed what Keynes called the animal spirits of the Indian private sector. The moral of the Indian story is that in economics that suffer from multiple distortions, small changes can make a big difference. The Chinese growth acceleration after 1978 very much bears this out. The Chinese economic takeoff wasn't the product of economy-wide reforms or a major liberalization. It was the consequence of specific reforms that loosened collective farming rules and allowed farmers to sell excess production after state quotas were fulfilled, at uncontrolled market prices. The same type of selective, targeted reforms in urban industrial development, trade, foreign investment, and finance would unfold over the next three decades, keeping the Chinese miracle going and going. Or consider Mauritius, one of Africa's few growth successes in the 20th century, which experienced its growth acceleration in 1971. The trigger there seems to have been the establishment of a largely unregulated export processing zone that led to a boom in garment exports, even as the rest of the economy remained heavily controlled and protected. What is common to these cases is that the takeoffs were associated with a targeted removal of key obstacles to growth, rather than broad liberalization and economy-wide reforms. India, China and Mauritius all benefited from growth strategies that specifically focused on removing binding constraints on growth. Targeting reforms on areas where the growth returns are the greatest maximizes early benefits. It also ensures that scarce political capital and administrative resources are spent on the battles that really matter. Maximum gain for minimum pain. In a 2005 article, Ricardo Hausmann, Andres Velasco, and I sought to identify these binding constraints to growth in specific settings. For example, an economy in which the main constraint on growth was poor access to finance should exhibit different symptoms: high interest rates, strong responsiveness of domestic investment to foreign capital inflows, and so on, than an economy whose main problem was low profitability of private investment. Low interest rates, ample liquidity in the bank.